Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the election of a new mayor in New York City, Bill de Blasio, and speak with Hank Scheinkopf, and Democratic strategist who has run numerous campaigns in New York City and state, as well as many national campaigns. We will discuss whether the election of a left-wing populist to succeed a plutocrat is a harbinger of political change for both New York City and the nation. Then we'll look into the results of the race for governor in Virginia with Ed Kilgore, the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist and the principal writer for The Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. We will discuss the political and psychological value of the Democratic pickup of a Republican governorship and how the winds of change that first favored the Democrats for 2014 because of the unpopular Republican shutdown of the government seem to have swung back against the Democrats due to the troubled launch of the Affordable Care Act. Then finally, with the rebel group, the M23, announcing they are laying down their arms, we will assess the future for peace in the Congo, which for the past two decades has been mired in the world's most deadly and intractable conflict that has claimed over 6 million lives. Maurice Carney, the co-founder and executive director of the human rights group The Friends of the Congo, joins us to provide history and context to this monstrous tragedy of death, plunder, and pillage that the world has largely ignored. And joining us now is Hank Scheinkopf, the president of Scheinkopf Communications Limited. He has been a political, public affairs, and corporate media consultant for over 25 years and has advised Democratic political campaigns at every level from city council to president in every region of the United States, including many races in New York City and New York State. He's also a member of the Clinton-Gore 1996 campaign media team. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hank Scheinkopf.
Thank you for having me on.
And It's actually more of a surprise that there hasn't been a Democratic mayor elected in New York City since 1989. So with a 6-to-1 advantage in registration, why have the Democrats been in the wilderness for so long?
Republicans tend to get elected in New York to the office of mayor, not much else, frankly, only in times of crisis. If you look at New York City history for the last, let's say, 50 years or so, a little bit more maybe, 60 years, LaGuardia, Fiorello, LaGuardia, the great, well-known mayor, was elected, and the crisis at the time was corruption. The next Republican elected was John Lindsay. The crisis when he got elected was the death of the political machines and the breakdown of city services and overnight demographic shift. Then the next one was Rudy Giuliani. The crisis was crime. And the final mayor who got elected as a Republican in this chronology was one Michael R. Bloomberg in 2001, and the crisis was 9/11. So you have crises that elect Republicans. We've lived through 20 years of crisis, and people who voted here, frankly, most of them don't remember or didn't live or weren't here when the city was in a downtrend and there was a crisis. So they are responding and going back to what New Yorkers normally do, which is to vote left.
And do you think that Bill de Blasio's theme, his campaign theme of the Tale of Two Cities, did it catch on? Because basically he was dividing the moneyed Manhattan elite from the 46% of New Yorkers who live at or near the poverty level. And of course, 46% is awfully close to the 47% that Mitt Romney talked about, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is. Did de Blasio reach what the late Tony Schwartz, the great media consultant, called the responsive chord? No question about it. He found elements of that resentment of outer borough, non-Manhattan residents, and he used it appropriately. And they revolved around several very significant issues. The income gap, the stop and frisk, which is a policy of the police department, stop and frisk people, it just came through the federal court, and the policy was upheld. But who knows what the appeals court will do. So it was stop and frisk, income gap, pre-K required, and the rich people be taxed for it, and a tax on the rich generally, which people seem to support. And those were things that, and 200,000 more units of affordable housing to be created during his tenure. Those are issues that mattered to people, and always a candidate that wins tends to be the candidate who says the appropriate thing or is in the right place at the right time, and is the one that people really feel strongly about. In this case, de Blasio exactly picked up the moment and ran like anyone would to the goal line.
And do you think, though, Hank, that he has broken the political mold here? Because politicians have been so afraid of taxes, and you've got people like Grover Norquist who've made a career out of intimidating politicians into taking in the no-tax pledge, and it seems to have basically intimidated the Democrats as well as controlled the Republicans. So is in him breaking the no-tax mold and not being ashamed of saying we need to raise taxes on the rich to pay for pre-K and other programs for young kids, is this something that's going to change the political dynamic in the country?
It might. We don't know. You can't change a political dynamic until you have some history and you see that things work. And then politicians, who, by the way, are not the most, they're not the most risk-taking individuals. They're rather risk-averse. And they need to see that it works, and then they might repeat the same thing around the country. But the difference here is in New York, New York is the most overtaxed place in the country. We pay more taxes in New York City than any place else. We pay city, state, and federal with withholding taxes. We pay a New York City corporate tax, which penalizes really and taxes again the income of people who own businesses. It's quite a system. Point being that the people who don't have the money to pay those kinds of taxes because they don't have to are the people that are majority in the city. And they said, fine, let's equalize things. And that's why they voted for Bill de Blasio. Is that a precursor of what might happen around the country? You got to see if it works first.
Well, of course, and frankly, he's got some hurdles, hasn't he, with the governor, Cuomo, and the legislature.
Tremendous hurdles. On 2014 is an election year. Bill de Blasio takes office for the state. Bill de Blasio will take office if he's elected. He's expected to win handily on January 1st, 2014. Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York State and the legislature, will be running for re-election. That kind of tax is not something the mayor can do unilaterally. The mayor of the city of New York is only permitted to raise taxes on real estate and to raise fees for certain services. He can't unilaterally raise those kinds of taxes. He's got to go to the legislature, and it's not likely in an election year that the legislature will say, yes, let's tax more people. It's not something that happens. On the police front, though, New York has gone through a resurgence because of the reduction in crime. Nobody seemed to mind the stop and frisk argument, nor did they believe that that would somehow hinder the police department's ability to fight crime. And nor did they blame de Blasio for it. So that, too, is kind of something to pay attention to.
Again, I'm speaking with Hank Shinecoff, the president of Shinecoff Communications Limited, who has been a political, public affairs, and corporate media consultant for over 25 years. He has advised Democratic political campaigns at every level, from city council to president, in every region of the United States, including many races in New York City and New York State. He's also a member of the Clinton-Gore 1996 campaign media team. So this is no small job that Bill de Blasio is taking on. He oversees 300,000 employees and has a $70 billion budget. But there's also quite a lot of navigating of the various interests intersecting here. And he has a reputation of being, even though he's an unapologetic progressive, he seems to be able to work pretty much with most people. So what's your understanding? Do you know him, by the way, Hank?
I do, and I'm fond of him. I think he's very smart. He's very capable. He is his basic style of operating is to try to get everybody who's in opposition to one another into a room and to get them to sit down and try to come up with some conclusion where everybody wins. He's a win-win kind of guy. But he is very sure about his ideology and very, very committed to income equalization. The problem here, or reducing the income imbalance is a better way to say it. The problem here is that the government of the United States has talked about dealing with the income gap, and it's not been capable. Governors across the country have talked about it, and with limited success, have done anything. Other people have said an awful lot. If de Blasio is successful here, and there's now groundswell of opposition, it will be a model for the rest of the country to follow. And he will have proven that economic populism can work in a much less unionized world, which is pretty amazing when you put it in context.
So the New York Post's rather scandalous headline of Back in the USSR, which was a reference to a trip that de Blasio made to the Soviet Union 30 years ago when he was a student, I take it that class warfare fell pretty flat, right?
You're talking about the place where the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire happened, which effectively launched what we know as unionism and the industrial side. And, you know, it happened here in New York City, a place that has something named Union Square. We have more people in unions probably than any other place in the country per capita. So attacking someone for being on the left at a time when everybody's forgotten what the right looks like is a great help and probably got him some votes.
Well, one of the things that Amitai Etzioni, a very famous sociologist, mentioned in a conversation I had with him a while back, he pointed out the disparity between Democrats and Republicans in as much as Republicans, and this is, I think, when Mitt Romney was running, we had this conversation. Remember Mitt Romney, all of the Republicans sort of stumble over each other to be the first to say, I'm a proud conservative. And it got so strident and so absurd that Mitt Romney called himself a severe conservative. And that's the only pointed out. He said, but I don't hear Democrats standing up and saying, I'm a proud liberal or I'm a proud progressive. Is this going to change with de Blasio?
It may very well change with de Blasio. Not so much the word liberal, but progressive. What has occurred in New York, if that is to be a bellwether for the nation, is that every candidate who won citywide office referred to him or herself as a progressive and proud, that most of the city council, which we have 51 members, 28 of them were non-incumbents in open seats. Most of them were supported by the left-leaning Working Families Party, which is certainly progressive, and the progressive mantra does not have the stain that the liberal argument has, that calling someone a liberal does. Frankly, in New York, to be called a progressive is a fine thing. It gets you votes, it makes you friends, and probably allows you to do some things you ought not to be doing, because progressives, just like others, tend to go to jail if they break the law and engage in corruption. That being said, there's no crime to being a progressive in New York.
Well, wasn't it a Republican, though, Teddy Roosevelt, that ushered
exactly
in the progressive era in New York, right?
Yep, such as the progressives are. The problem, the other side of it is people need to read their history and remember what progressives did. They also were not, I don't think, great friends of unions, and they spent an awful lot of time depoliticizing municipal government, which sometimes works and oftentimes does not.
So this fellow then that you know, this de Blasio, who's been vilified by Murdoch, but you're saying that he's actually much more pragmatic. No,
I'm not saying he's pragmatic. He is a progressive and he does have core beliefs, but he can make things work.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that's pragmatic. I think that's he understands the job. The job is still to govern.
So he's very ambitious,
and he's been successful at that, you know.
So then he's a combination of principle and practicality. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's extraordinarily well said. He is a combination of principle and practicality, and in order to govern a city like New York, where you have a budget, as you noted, of $70 billion, you have 300,000 employees, all with open contracts. I might add, we've had no unions, no public sector union settlements for quite some time. A place where anything can happen at any time and usually does, and where in one part of the city, the borough of Queens, where 170 languages are spoken on a daily basis, you have to be pretty practical to get things done.
So how did he do it, though? Because he was not even considered on the radar when this race began. The people that were getting the headlines were the Speaker, Christine Quinn, and, of course, ex-Congressman Anthony Weiner.
He did it because, first of all, luck has a lot to do with winning things, and he got lucky. That's item one. But more importantly, he ran a tremendously disciplined, very smart, targeted campaign that stayed on its principle, its major argument, and didn't move. And he has been an opponent of stop and frisk by the police in New York City for quite some time. He put himself in the middle of the health care crisis by protesting the closing of hospitals. And he understood that his strength to win was in the outer boroughs and not in Manhattan. And he played to it very well. He had good union support, which meant the people on the streets pulling people to the polls. And he just continued, and the opponents, frankly, ran bad campaigns. Bad campaigns.
Well, one of them ran a surreal campaign, Anthony Weiner.
Well, you know, that's not the kind of advertising you want, especially online. You know, you want a different kind. It, look, the other thing, the de Blasio campaign made tremendously good use of social media. They spent less money on direct mail, which Californians will find upsetting, or, depending upon your point of view, happy. But they spent less trees were birded to make this New York campaign work than at any other time in history of recent note. Most of the money went on television and into social media and into field. That's what the eye shows. The reports may show something different. But that was very smart, and it worked well.
And did his family help in the social media?
His family was helpful overall. What the picture that you got here was of a biracial family that where all the people in the family loved each other very much, cared deeply about the city and themselves and their future in it, and were united in their desire to see Bill de Blasio, husband and father, become the mayor of the nation's largest city. Pretty extraordinary, I'd say.
So what do you think is going to be the mood on Wall Street tomorrow?
Municipal bond people are going to be happy because they're going to see a left-leaning progressive in office, which means more money will get borrowed for more programs, and that'll be great. People who are very moneyed will be very nervous. The real estate industry will be less nervous than Wall Street will, the real estate developers, because de Blasio said publicly, we need less luxury condos, we need more affordable housing. And he keeps throwing the 200,000 affordable unit numbers around, and that's not insignificant. And that means that some people who are used to making a lot of money in one way won't be able to do that if the incoming mayor, should he be the one, have his way. So real estate guys will be a lot more nervous than Wall Street will tomorrow.
But in terms of his signature and core campaign issue, which was to tax the rich to invest in pre-K and after-school programs, that ultimately is going to be decided at the state legislature level and by the governor, right? Is that the message you gave us?
There is an extraordinary fact about life back east in New York City. If you are the mayor, you don't have as much power as you think, because ultimately you are a ward of the state, and the state can decide what happens and doesn't happen, and getting that tax to taxing the rich beyond real estate taxes to fund pre-K, universal pre-K, is not going to be an easy trick.
Well, but it may change the national dialogue. It may not be successful, but at least at this point, that seems to be the takeaway, that this might be a harbinger for a new era of activist liberal governance.
There is no question, but if Bill de Blasio is successful simply by oratory, if he is an aspirational mayor and an inspirational mayor, that he can change the national dialogue and reinstitute a serious discussion about the future of our cities and the education of our children, and that would probably be a very good thing.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Hank Shinecoff.
Thank you for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Hank Shinecoff, who's the president of Shinecoff Communications Limited, who has been a political, public affairs, and corporate media consultant for over 25 years. He has advised Democratic political campaigns at every level, from city council to president, in every region of the United States, including many races in New York City and New York State. He was also a member of the Clinton-Gore 1996 campaign team. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the results of the governor's race in Virginia that are still coming in. I could trip a referee, tell by my attitude that I most definitely leave from.